The Women's Media Center, founded in 2005 by Jane Fonda, Gloria Steinem, and myself, is a progressive, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization working to make women visible and powerful in media. You can learn more about the WMC at womensmediacenter.com.
You're listening to Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan.
Welcome back. Few journalists have written so probingly and exhaustively on women in various countries in Africa, and particularly South Africa, than Stephanie Erdang. She was born there, and she emigrated to the United States at the end of the 1960s. She became active in the anti-apartheid and solidarity movements in the late 1960s onwards. Her journalism career began with the editing of Southern Africa Magazine, a publication of the Southern African Committee based in New York, and this led to an invitation to visit the liberated zones of Guinea-Bissau in 1974. Her book, Fighting Two Colonialisms, Women in Guinea-Bissau, was based on this and on subsequent visits to independent Guinea-Bissau. In 1980, she was awarded a grant from the Ford Foundation to undertake research on women in post-independent Mozambique, and this led to her second book, And Still They Dance, Women, War, and the Struggle for Change in Mozambique. She was the research director for the American Committee on Africa, an NGO and activist organization, the one that spearheaded the successful divestment campaign in the United States. She began her work as a consultant for the UN in 1979, when she joined the staff of the mid-decade UN World Conference on Women, and she wrote widely on the effects of apartheid on women in Southern Africa. She produced and ran training workshops on gender and development for the United Nations Development Program, UNDP, and other UN agencies, and she was senior advisor on gender and HIV/AIDS for UNIFEM. In 2005, she co-founded with human rights lawyer Rakia Omar the NGO Rwanda Gift for Life, which supported women who had been raped during the 1994 genocide and were, as a consequence, living with AIDS. She's both an activist and an observer and a reporter, and her memoir, Mapping My Way Home, Activism, Nostalgia, and the Downfall of Apartheid South Africa, was published late last year. And this spring, she is currently completing a young adult book in collaboration with a survivor of the Rwandan genocide, which relates the story of his survival when he was only 11. And it'll be published shortly. She lives in the United States, but she returns regularly to South Africa. And it's very good indeed to welcome Stephanie Erdang. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Robin. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I wanted to get you on for some time because South Africa, unless something dreadful is happening there, drops off the world's consciousness when that's rather foolish for so many reasons. I've been there. I loved it there. I also hated things about it. And I am so eager to hear from you, who were born in South Africa and are a crack journalist, and who has written many books about it. Tell us what is going on now and what's been happening in a few minutes. Tell us what's been happening since liberation from apartheid.
Right.
Basically, it's been 25 years now, hasn't it?
It is 25 years since 1994, when the first democratic election took place.
Yes.
And as we know, Nelson Mandela became the first African president.
Yes.
So that was a very, very critical part of South Africa's history. And there was enormous hope at that time.
Yeah.
And people really felt that South Africa was going to be a model, a beacon of hope for the whole of the continent.
The Constitution was so beautiful. It still is the best,
and it is.
Best constitution in the world, yeah.
Absolutely, and the way that it deals with gender and same-sex people, it's been really, you know, remarkable. It's ground-setting. So that's a very, very strong part of South Africa's recent history, is that strong constitution. And there's a lot that's happened that has been very, very positive. The press is free. The Constitutional Court is very, very important. And more recently, there's been a number of commissions, particularly the Zondo Commission into Corruption in South Africa.
Yes.
I think probably what people have heard of most in recent years has been the corruption.
Yes.
Ramaphosa, the current president, has replaced leaders of the government, of government departments, such as the prosecuting agency. And another very strong issue in South Africa, which people don't know about that much, are the social grants. Mm-hmm. Given the level of poverty in South Africa, these are really, really important. So there's not only the old age, so-called old age pensions, but they're grants for children up to the age of 18. Mm. They're disability grants, they're caregiver grants, they're war veterans grants, they're foster child grants. And all of these together actually make it possible for people who are otherwise in dire poverty to survive. Mm. And those are very important aspects of South Africa and something we can really applaud.
Yes.
The problems are big. Poverty is rife. There's low status of women. There's tremendous gender-based violence. There's a very high rate of HIV, which, you know, in this country we sort of think of as more as a chronic disease at this point.
Right.
In South Africa, it's very, very prevalent. Over 5 million people are infected. That's about 1 in 5. Mm. Gender-based violence accounts for probably about 20% of new infections.
Yeah.
Women are simply unable to negotiate safe sex. They have low status, lack of empowerment. And the whole aspect of poverty has led to what has been called sugar daddies or blessers,
yeah,
where older men prey on young women. There's the whole question of caregiving when people are sick, because that's the role of women, to provide the care in the families.
Naturally.
This is a tremendous draw on women's lives. Women tend to get tested more frequently than men. Men sort of think they may be weak if they go and get tested, and they're terrified of the results. But, you know, so how I see it is that HIV and gender-based violence are very much interrelated.
Yeah.
It's estimated that 1 in 3 women have been assaulted in South Africa. And that's amongst the highest in the world.
Yes.
So it's not a pretty picture when it comes to that. However, the Constitution really tries to protect that. The question is the implementation.
Mm-hmm. And which means political will.
Right, yeah. Right. And it's really been left up to some people organizing and NGOs and a very, very vibrant resistance to what's going on.
Mm.
And that's where I find the hope in South Africa. Is the people.
It's interesting because when I was there in 98, of course, the period you speak of, when hopes were so high and celebratory, and if we did this, and we did this in a fairly bloodless way, the world expected a, you know, bloodbath, but in fact it was a fair, relatively speaking, it was a nonviolent revolution with a great constitution. If we did this, we can do anything. And it was so heady. I mean, you were happily, cheerfully drunk with hope and joy.
Right.
And the two things that set me back a bit, because I was there in Joburg in Cape Town, in Stellenbosch, in a number of places, to talk with women and learn the status of women primarily. So the first thing that really, you know, gobsmacked me was the status of women. Although I was also blown away by the activism. Every every group was cloning itself into five other mm-hmm. groups. Wherever you turned, oh no, we're a new group and we're focusing on, and the energy was very high, and they were taking advantage of technology in a way that some northern global north countries, women's movements were not, because the distances yeah. were so wide. That was very terrifying, but also encouraging. The other right. thing, and I'm curious as to whether this has changed, was that, for example, in Stellenbosch, the power hadn't changed. The money hadn't changed. The great vineyards were still all owned by white folks and all worked by black folks. And the power imbalanced in terms of sheer who owns what was pretty much the same. Has that altered at all?
It's altered in the sense that there are now more blacks as part of the middle class and upper middle class. Uh-huh. So that, you know, we can't say that only the whites are uh-huh. controlling the economy. It's a mixed, more complex situation now. But I think what that kind of power relationship is still very, very obvious. Yeah. And I think that, you know, one of the questions at the bottom of this is the land question.
Yes.
And I think it's very hard to understand South Africa unless one understands that. That historically, in terms of apartheid, Africans were relegated to about 10 or 11% of the land. That was the land they were entitled to live in and be citizens of. They lost their citizenship rights in the country of their birth. Mm. And those were the so-called Bantustans that were set aside as right. quote-unquote independent countries, which of course nobody yeah. recognized.
Yes.
The rest of the country was allocated to whites, but you know, the good rural areas, the urban areas, and Africans only had rights to come into the so-called white areas.
To labor.
If they'd, exactly. And their passports had to show that they were there legally, otherwise they were arrested, and there were just, you know, thousands and thousands of arrests
yes.
as a result of that. The land was taken away from even people that had land rights, because before 1910, Africans were able to actually own land. Otherwise, the land is owned by chiefs or, you know, by the large right. ethnic communities.
Right.
So as long as you had a contract that showed that you owned the land, you were entitled to that land.
Mm-hmm.
But that was also removed. And so we now have a situation where people are really beginning to demand, as you can imagine, their land.
Yeah.
And it's still in terms of the rural areas, it's in the vast hands of white farmers.
Yes.
Some of whom have actually left the country but still own the land. And so this is one of the biggest challenges ahead for Ramaphosa, is how he's going to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's unfortunate that it wasn't dealt with right on from the beginning.
I do too.
It's now being dealt with because he's being pressured.
I see.
And then it becomes something of a pressure cooker,
yeah.
you know, ready to explode. So we don't really know where that's going to go. At the moment, the policy is that land will not be grabbed in the way that it was in Zimbabwe, but that land that's unoccupied will be reallocated, and then we'll see what goes after that.
Interestingly.
But it's not really clear at this moment what the future is in this particular area.
Interestingly, one of the positions of Winnie Mandela, the much maligned,
mm-hmm.
was land.
Exactly.
And she was ticked off at her husband, because at Nelson, because he forfeited, well, he didn't forfeit mm-hmm. land, but I mean, he forfeited the issue at the very beginning. Whereas had it been dealt with at the beginning, as you say, it would be a very different South Africa today.
Yeah.
And
there's a lot of, you know, obviously hurt and anger over that.
Of course.
So, you know, but it's interesting because I've visited South Africa pretty frequently. But I was there in June last year, which was about 6 months after Ramaphosa took over from President Zuma.
Yeah.
And at that point, whenever I asked anybody, you know, so what are you thinking? What do you feel about the new president? Was, oh, we're so hopeful. I think things are going to change. You know, we really can see the light. This is excellent.
Yeah.
Going back now, I've just come back. I asked some of the same people, and they said they have no hope. They just feel that South Africa is on such a downward spiral. Now, that's not everybody. But there is, I did get a sense that of that hope that we were breaking out of the hold of Zuma and the corruption that went with it.
Yes, he was a
what
disaster.
Has been called state. Yeah, total disaster. And as we like to say, at least we got rid of the president.
That's right. It's
been a little harder in this country.
Yes.
But it's at a real crux now in terms of what can happen and what kind of power Ramaphosa can master. There are still many of the old guard.
What about the leadership of women? There are so many incredible South Africa. I think of Frene. I think of Preg's governor.
Governor.
Yeah, of Navi Pillay. I mean, there's so in middle leadership, in pipeline, in top leadership, and in NGO on the ground, there are just these incredible women working day and night with a real different vision and the muscle to put behind it. Is it still just so hopelessly...
That still goes on, and there's a kind of vibrancy in South Africa that I love when I go there because of the work that's being done on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's not only the NGOs or the women, for example, that you mentioned, but in the rural areas, in the townships, protesting against the bad service delivery, a constant kind of pushing back. It's almost as if the anti-apartheid movement and their struggle entered the DNA of South Africans, and they say, whatever happens, we continue to struggle. It's part of our who we are.
Yes, in 1989, when I was there, 1999, there were women organizing in KwaZulu-Natal against the Zulu tradition and superstition that if a man had AIDS, if he slept with a virgin, that would cure him. And there were women organizing over this and saying, you're killing our daughters. You will not do this. And their houses were being burnt down, these women. Their goats their goats were being slaughtered in punishment. And they were still organizing. All that amazing energy and dedication has to go somewhere, surely.
Yeah, and that's why I'm still an optimist. I mean, I have not given up on South Africa because there are the structures in place and there are the kind of organizing that you've described. And they're just across the board. There are men and organizing against violence and some very impressive organizations working with women, understanding that we also have to change the attitudes and behavior of men. It's not just, women fighting for their rights. So there is that, and that's a kind of leitmotif or an undercurrent that really exists in South Africa. And I think, you know, that has not been broken. But there is more frustration because it seems to be, you know, getting harder. It is 25 years.
Yeah.
And people had hoped that we would be in a different place.
What do you think it will take, Stephanie?
That's such a big question.
Yes,
I mean, it's a very important question, actually. Certainly the leadership has to root out corruption in every single way, because this is something that all South Africans know about. And unless there's actually implementation and indictments that result from the commissions that are now, you know, being televised daily on TV, so everybody knows what's happening.
Uh-huh. That's good.
But I think, you know, one of Ramaphosa's first acts would need to be rooting that out totally.
Uh-huh.
And really making an effort to show that there's a new government in charge.
Yeah.
Whether he can do that is the big question, because there's a real tension between the ANC members that really want change, the old guard who are very disappointed in what's happening now, very angry about what's happening, trying to save the ANC, and then the corruption that is very attractive to people who are corrupt.
Of course.
It's very hard for them to give that up.
Yeah.
So there has to be a very, very firm stand on that. And I think, you know, and I don't have a crystal ball. I just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it was interesting being there just a few weeks before the election, and in some ways it may not have been a good time to be there because people were so obsessed about the sort of day-to-day announcements, the discussions, you know, this party versus that, who people were going to vote for, that it was harder to get an overview, you know, sort of to get a sense of the pulse of the country that I like getting when I go back. I try and go back pretty much every year or two. So I still, you know, there was still, but the positive part of that, about that was there was this engagement of everybody.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the debates, whether it was on TV or radio or at bus stops or in supermarkets or in the townships, people were talking about it constantly. And expressing their anger, expressing their hopes, you know, wanting change. And as you say, there's this sort of groundswell of or an undercurrent of resistance that continues.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hope that that's what will win out in the end.
That's where we place our trust, I guess.
Yeah,
Stephanie. Stephanie has written this wonderful memoir, Mapping My Way Home, Activism, Nostalgia, and the Downfall of Apartheid South Africa, which I highly recommend. And I thank you for your insight and the work that you've done and the work you continue to do. And I thank you, Stephanie, for being with us today. I hope you'll come back and check with us again and update us after your next trip.
Well, I'd love to do that. And thank you so much for having me on your show.